Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is all things solar. In a speech outside a Mountain View Walmart last Friday, President Obama announced a broad new set of initiatives aimed at financing new solar businesses, training and developing a solar workforce, and improving energy efficiency. The announcement came as the solar industry experiences unprecedented growth, thanks to a combination of falling prices, subsidies, and increased demand by environmentally conscious consumers. Over the last 3 years, the White House reports the cost of a home solar energy system has dropped by more than 50%. And last year, about a quarter of new power generation was from solar, second only to natural gas. California in particular has benefited from solar's gains. The state employs a third of workers in the industry and leads the nation in total installed solar capacity. So what are the implications of solar's rapid rise for the consumer and for our energy future as a whole? Is now the time to go solar? And how should consumers be compensated for the energy they produce? And how are the state's big utilities responding to what some see as a threat to the very way of their doing business? Joining me in the studio tonight to shed light on these issues and more are Steve Weissman. He's director of the Energy Program, Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at Berkeley Law. Previously, Steve was an administrative law judge for the California Public Utilities Commission, a PUC staff attorney, and principal consultant to the California State Assembly's Committee on Natural Resources. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Cal Broomhead. He is the Climate and Energy Programs Manager at the San Francisco Department of Environment, where he has developed and managed the city's private sector energy programs in energy efficiency, renewable energy, green building, and climate action. Welcome, Cal.
Great to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Jonathan Bass. He's Vice President of Communications for Solar City, a solar energy company for homeowners, businesses, and government organizations, providing solar power system design, financing, installation, and monitoring services. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and you can dial 415-841-4134 to be part of that conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment right at our KLW website. So, Stephen Weissman from Berkeley, I wanted to start with you. Last month was the 60th anniversary of the photovoltaic cell, which is kind of the whole reason we can go solar these days. Give us some highlights of how solar energy or the use of solar energy has evolved over those 60 years.
Well, the biggest part of the way the usage has evolved really tracks what's happened to price. I remember there was a study done for Congress in 1980 saying that for solar to cut through, there was going to have to be a reduction from the current price, which at that point was about $10 per installed watt, down to $1 per installed watt, and they predicted that would happen in 1988. Well, we didn't get there then, but there's been a dramatic shift in the last handful of years, and now solar is very much within that range. And so this is the price changes have really reflected a change in demand, but also have driven a change in demand.
Mm. So you mentioned the demand changing. What actually drove that demand?
This is an area where there was a perceived need by government to push the technology by creating demand, and it did that by creating a series of incentives. Tax credits on the federal level, very important, 30% tax credit for investing in a solar system. Net metering, which is, I can describe in more detail if you like, 43 states plus the District of Columbia adopted net metering standards, which have allowed people who have solar installed in a home or business to not only use some of that on site, but also to feed some of that back into the grid and get very generous compensation for doing that. That's made a huge difference. Also, changes in the way rates have been set, especially on the residential level, where there's been a movement to rates that are much steeper the more you use, and that's created incentive for some of the customers with the highest level of demand to move to solar sooner. So these things together have really had a very large impact on demand.
And has it been a progressive, gradual, even rise over the last 60 years, or have we seen the spurt, so to speak, more recently?
it's really been a recent very large spurt. You've seen a doubling of installed solar year after year for the last several years. But before that, it was a much more modest increase. It really took hold as the prices started to drop in the last few years.
And thinking back to the early days, so to speak, of solar back 60 or so years ago, what was the thinking then about whether this would ever take off? Were there people who were concerned about whether solar was safe, for example? I'm thinking of other types of energy that we've talked about, you know, nuclear energy. But then, you know, I think of the electric car that kind of came and went and now is back on again. Tell us a little bit about the potential ups and downs in terms of solar's acceptability.
Fortunately, I can't give you much of a direct report on what was going on 60 years ago. I think that what was happening 60 years ago was really the creation of something that had very modest uses at the time. Solar was incorporated in the space program. You saw transistor radios with little solar cells on them. Very, very modest kind of operation. What started to change the conversation really was the series of oil crises that we had in the 1970s. In 1978, there were five pieces of federal legislation that were passed that in different ways were trying to move the United States off of oil. And you saw Carter at that time installing solar water heaters on the roof of the White House. There was a lot more money put into research and development,
which were then taken down by Reagan, and I hear being put back on by Obama. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. They're back up now, but yeah, one of the first things that Reagan did was to make sure he got those darn solar collectors off the roof of the White House. But that was also indicative of the way the Reagan administration and then the administrations that followed were treating the programs that had been put in place in 1978. So the research and development dollars started to be reduced fairly substantially. One of the things that was required in the 1978, one of the acts in 1978, was that each state consider whether or not to adopt a net metering program. And so that put the issue up in front of state legislatures and governors all over the country. The fact that you had, in a very small number of years, 43 of the states in the District of Columbia willing to adopt this program is indicative, I think, of what people were thinking about solar at the time. Where were the utilities that are so good at resisting these kinds of legislative initiatives when they see them as being a threat? They were fairly much laying back at that time because they weren't seeing solar as a threat. It was very expensive. Production was relatively limited. And there wasn't the kind of traction that caused them to start to believe they were going to have their business model threatened in any way.
But that sounds like maybe that's changing.
It's changed quite a bit, and you've seen within the last 3 or 4 years an initiative that's been somewhat orchestrated across the country where utilities have been hammering very hard on state legislatures, talking about the kind of what they refer to as the subsidies that are derived from the net metering process, and suddenly being very sensitive to what they see as being things such as social equity questions, the potential that maybe it's going to be the more well-to-do customers are going to be installing solar, and then the other customers are going to be left to cover the remaining fixed costs of the system and have higher rates and, in effect, be subsidizing the wealthier customers. This is an argument that's been repeated all over the country. There's also the argument that the net metering customers could potentially zero out their entire bill, so they wind up with no indebtedness to the utility even after an entire year's period. But these customers are still arguably relying on some of the fixed components of the system and they're not paying for them. So utilities have been kind of pushing on those arguments as well.
Thank you for that really great summary of where solar has been over the last 60 years, but particularly more recently. That was Stephen Weissman, who is the director of the energy program at Berkeley Law. I wanted to turn to Cal Broomhead from San Francisco's Department of Environment to pick up on some of the last points that Steve made there, specifically about if we look at the demographics of who's adopting solar in San Francisco. Again, this concern that there is a predominance of wealthy consumers who are taking advantage of solar given the upfront costs, and that somehow is skewing the costs of energy for people at the lower income brackets. Can you say anything about how that appears to you or what your assessment of that question and concern is here in San Francisco?
Well, without being able to make an assessment, I can't tell you what we've done. Mm. And you can go to sfenergymap.org, and you'll see a static map that shows you all of the installations that have been installed, over 3,800 of them around the city. You'll notice that if you look in the southeast part of the city, there's a very large number of them in our lower-income neighborhoods as well. And that's largely due to the fact that we have the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission program, their incentives. They have given incentives to installations that have been in low and low-moderate income homes. In addition, we've had a number of free programs where we have had job training and solar installation that we have done and targeted low-income neighborhoods throughout the city. So I think he's right, and there is an issue that we do need to be thinking about equity, but this is the same case with the digital divide and many other things, inequities that we find in our society. A lot of the older homes have a lot of maintenance problems. They have roofing, maybe a weak roof. It's difficult to install. I'm sure that John can probably talk about a number of rooftop scare stories that he's probably encountered. But these are issues, and I think that it is right to bring it up. It's something to be talked about, particularly if we think about continuing on this rooftop solar. But there are limitations to it. If we blanketed every single rooftop in San Francisco with photovoltaics, the full potential, and we have done a digital map of every rooftop in the city, we'll get 7.1% of our electric load in the city can be met with rooftop solar. So our primary problem is not rooftop solar. I mean, it's a great thing, and we need to do that, but we also need to be thinking about other resources to bring into the city. We're a very dense, compact city, so we need to be thinking about, so where are we going to get all the rest of that renewable energy? A lot of it's going to come in through transmission lines, and we're going to be in partnership with PG&E on that as long as they remain in charge of the transmission system, and with the California ISO.
So is it the same issue that we have about San Francisco real estate, that there's just only so much surface area you can cover with photovoltaic cells?
That's true.
Oh, so 7%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but I don't think anyone in this renewable energy debate is really thinking that any one particular source is going to solve the problem.
Correct.
Yeah. So what else are you looking at? And we'll just kind of talk about that, and then we'll move back to solar. What else are you hoping for?
Sure. We're also looking at wave energy. We had taken, some listeners might remember, of taking a quick look at tidal current power underneath the Golden Gate Bridge with the tides coming in and out, and we concluded that there really wasn't a lot of potential there and it would be very expensive. But now we're looking at wave energy, and it's being tested, piloted in different places around the world. When we find that we have machines that we think are going to withstand Pacific Coast storms, and we've done our Public Utilities Commission has commissioned a crustacean study and a whale study and a sediment study. So we've done all the studies that we need, and now we're looking for the right equipment and the right method of being able to put something in off of our coast, hopefully a type of a wave energy that would be below the surface of the water, probably on the seabed, and would absorb the wave energy that's mm-hmm. down below and then bring that on shore.
I just wanted to unpack a little bit of this idea that in fact, in San Francisco, based on all the incentives that you described, that there is a much more equitable distribution than maybe a lot of people fear of solar. You know, a lot of neighborhoods, including the southeast corner of the city, are undergoing tremendous change. For example, the T-3rd Street line brought a lot of people to that part of the city, and there's been a lot of turnover of ownership of housing in that area. Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing? Are you seeing that growth in that area to the new owners in that area, or sort of the long-term residents of that area also adopting solar?
Well, actually, with our programs, we have targeted the low-income homes, and there are hundreds of families down there who can attest to it. I was talking to one of them just last week. In fact, in the mayor's Earth Day breakfast, he attested to a person in the audience that he knew lived down there who has solar on her home. We have many solar advocates in the southeast part of the city, as well as I believe it's over 121 people from low income come out of the city's training programs and have gotten jobs in solar and are now currently working for various solar companies around the Bay Area. So it's not just about putting solar on people's on the right people's roofs. It's also about getting the right people jobs.
Steve.
Well, I also think it's important to emphasize that with the kind of business model that's being used by companies like SolarCity right now, income level should not be much of a limitation in terms of your ability to have solar. You're more limited on an income basis in terms of who actually has a roof to put it on, because you have so many people living in multifamily dwellings, and they're not going to necessarily have control over the rooftop. And so that's a factor. But the fact that you have the ability to just purchase the power as it comes along, and you can currently price that power at a rate that's less than what you'd pay even in the lowest end for power from PG&E, means that anybody who has a home can also have solar.
And my understanding is that even in multi-unit dwellings, should the landlord decide to go that way, that the tenants in the building can also plug in. So
they can participate, but we need everybody to come together in a decision to do that.
You mean so per building?
Join the it's called a virtual net metering program, and it allows them to put one system on the roof and then provide the benefits to each of the tenants.
So Jonathan Bass of SolarCity, Steve did a great job of setting up your entry into the program this evening. Tell us about what he's talking about in terms of the business model. How are you able to bring solar to more people perhaps than originally thought? What are the ways that your strategies that you're employing?
Sure. And you mentioned it at the outset, one of the biggest barriers to adoption was traditionally the upfront costs. There was a certain type of homeowner that could write a check for $20,000 or $30,000 and see an excellent return on that over time. But there are a lot of other homeowners that want to participate in solar that might not feel comfortable doing that. So we created an option where the customer don't pay for the installation of the panels. They pay for the power the system produces, and typically at a discount to their utility rate. So it's possible to save money from day one by adopting solar.
And my understanding is that people can also lease the panels. Is that right?
Yes. It can be set up as a lease or a power purchase agreement. It's essentially the same. So the customer is paying for the power the system produces instead of the panels and installation. And the CPUC actually did a study about 18 months ago.
That's the California State.
Yes,
PUC. Okay.
Yes, the California Public Utilities Commission, taking a look at this issue, you know, who's adopting solar, where's the growth occurring? And it showed that there are 300% and 400% growth in lower income zip codes. So in zip codes below 75,000, 50,000 median income, that 300% and 400% growth rates were occurring there. The growth rate was occurring much faster in the low and medium income zip codes than it was even in the higher zip codes of the last few years. It's been a typical, you know, technology adoption curve. If you look at cell phones or PCs, the first cell phones in the 80s were bricks and they cost $2,000 a piece. And there was a certain type of consumer that had one of those. Now cell phones are ubiquitous. The costs have come down and new service plans have been created. Similar things are happening with solar. So you're going to see more and more different types of homeowners capable of adopting solar, and then other types of adoption for multifamily housing as well. We've done over 100 projects in California for affordable housing developments. So there are a range of new, you know, models emerging to let more and more different types of customers take advantage of it.
And sometimes my understanding is the reason that the adoption of the technology increases because prices come down is because the technology advances. But my understanding is that in solar, the way you did it 60 years ago is still pretty much the way you do it today. Is that right?
It is essentially. There have been improvements. A lot of the innovation has been focused on reducing the cost of manufacturing. There have been improvements in efficiency, incremental efficiency. Improvements over the years, but there hasn't been a big sea change in the technology, and Steve might be able to speak more to this. It really hasn't changed that much in the last 15, 20 years, and the electricity we use in our homes hasn't changed either. It produces AC, electricity. That's the value of the system. So there have been incremental improvements on the efficiency side, but really all the innovation has been poured into reducing the cost.
Say a little bit about that, Steve.
Well, I think Jonathan hit it just right. It's really been trying to make it less expensive to produce the materials themselves. And the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory up the hill from where I teach at Berkeley has done a year-over-year tracking of this, and they've shown how the overall install cost is going down, and a large portion of that has been on what you refer to as the hard side, the equipment itself. The soft side, the labor and paying for building permits and things like that, sometimes has been a little bit harder of a nut to crack. But what's happened with the technologies, a couple of things. One is that you've seen different national policies. China's the easy one to pick on, where there was a major incentives on the production side. They wanted to get their factories up and running and have them produce a lot of photovoltaics. Not so great on having incentives on the demand side. And so they wound up creating a major surplus of solar arrays, and then they needed to put them somewhere. They tried dumping some of them in the United States, and then they've tried to keep the prices low even if they're not in the dumping below cost level. So you've got that. And in terms of technological change, probably the only significant innovation, I think, has been what's referred to as amorphous thin-film photovoltaics, where instead of having a big case on the roof that looks like it's like a glassed-in picture with a frame around it, you might have something that's on a piece of metal so thin that you could actually just roll it out on the roof, or you can incorporate it into shingles. That kind of stuff, that's been, I think, moving ahead, and they've been finding ways to produce more of that faster at a lower cost. And so that's been one big change. Other than that, I think to the naked eye, a solar array looks like a solar array did maybe 30, 40 years ago.
But, you know, there have been some other innovations, and I think John could speak to this also, is the snap-on, clip-together, very quick installations that the equipment that you have now.
So small scale, large scale. It sounds like, you know, the sky's the limit on solar. And there's a lot of things to get more to. Net metering has come up about a dozen times so far. So we have to really get to that. We'll talk about how the utilities are jockeying for position at this point. And what are the nuts and bolts for those listeners out there who want to go solar? But before we get to that, let's take a really short break to ask for your support during this public radio party. Here at KLW, and joined right now by Bob Summer. Hey, Bob.
Hey, good evening. 1-800-525-997 is the number to call. We'd like to have 9 calls or clicks during City Visions. We can reach those goals with your help. It's the public radio party, and we need your support for this public radio station. We've got a challenge from a generous listener in Oakland who has put up $200, and we know that we can make that goal. We can get that money if you call now, 1-800-525-9917, or online at klw.org.
City Visions has been on the air for over 20 years, and we've invited you to join that conversation for those 20 years. We've been inviting you to the party, actually. And so won't you show your support and be part of the party here at KLW? 1-800-525-9917, or click on klw.org. Again, 9 clicks or calls in this hour. We'd love to see some long-time listeners, but new members. 1-800-525-9917, klw.org.
If this is the kind of information, the kind of programming you enjoy, then now is the time to call. I mean, you listen to this program, you learn new things every time you do. I learned something new tonight. I learned more about how maybe I can get solar in my house. If you get that kind of information, if you get this kind of if it enriches your life in that manner, then become a member of this public radio station. 1-800-525-9917 or online at KALW.org. Just about 30 seconds before we go back to the program. We are keeping our breaks short. We're not really interrupting the programming. We've built this one in. We want you to become a member of this public radio station.
So if you believe in KLW, if you want to keep hearing voices of leaders and innovators and the very people who move this city and region forward, 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org. And this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing all things solar with my guest, Steve Weissman, director of the energy program at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment at Berkeley Law. Cal Broomhead, climate and energy programs manager at the San Francisco Department of Environment, and Jonathan Bass, Vice President of Communications with Solar City. We invite you, our listeners, to call to join the conversation, and that number is 415-841-4134. That's, of course, right after you pledge. 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org, or you can post a comment at the KALW website. So I wanted to go to this net metering issue, Steve Weissman. So in the easiest of terms that you can describe it, can you tell us what net metering is and why it's so crucial to the explosion of the adoption of solar?
Well, first, the underlying challenge, which is that the sun doesn't always tend to shine when you want to use electricity. So how are you going to try to find a good match between what you're producing on your rooftop and having power when you need it? One way to do that would be to have some kind of battery or other kind of storage linked up to your solar so that you can save some of that energy to use later. But that adds cost, and the technology is only now starting to look more promising. So what net metering says is that when you are home, the sun's shining, and you want to use the power that you're producing, go ahead and do that. But when you're not demanding as much power as being produced by the system, then that power flows back into the distribution grid and gets used by other customers. What net metering means is that when you take power off the grid, it counts up, your meter counts up one more kilowatt hour, another one, et cetera. And if that's all you did, you'd get a bill at the end of the month for that amount. But net metering says that when you put power back into the grid, the meter in effect runs backwards and erases each one of those kilowatt hours that had already been counted. In most states, and California is one of them, you can't go past zero. In other words, you can take as much from the grid as you put back in the grid and wind up with no bill at the end of the month.
But you can't get more or get money from the utility.
You can't
get
money,
the credit.
You can't get money beyond that, but they're going to pay a much smaller rate for the power that you're putting back into the grid after you've balanced everything out. So why is this important? Let me use an example of the solar I have in my own home. I have a power purchase agreement, and the average cost of the power produced that I buy from that system is 10 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, if you look at the PG&E tariffs, that's a deal for me, even at the lowest tariff level, because the lowest amount of power you can use costs somewhere in the neighborhood of about 14 cents. So I'm saving 3 or 4 cents for every kilowatt hour in that instance. For those extra kilowatt hours I put back in the system, I'm also getting credited, in effect, that same 13 or 14 cents. So that's more than covering that 10-cent cost I have for the power. But it's a very delicate balance. If any of the major pieces were to fall away, then it suddenly things don't look so cost-effective. So I mentioned before there's a massive tax credit, 30% tax credit. That's scheduled to expire at this point at the end of 2016. If that goes away, then the solar company can't give me as good of a deal anymore. And if net metering was eliminated, again, the equation would change immediately. Instead of being able to get some savings above the 10-cent cost, I'd be getting maybe 4 or 5 cents for kilowatt hour that I'm putting back in the system. That would be a money loser for me. So to keep the economics looking good for end-use consumers, you need all of these incentives in place.
But from the perspective of the utilities?
Well, the utilities don't see it quite that way. Again, as I think I mentioned earlier, that every customer, including a net metering customer, relies on the fact that there is equipment in place. There's a meter. There's I can't remember any terms now. You got a distribution
lines.
System. Lines. That's good. That's good. A transformer. That's the one I couldn't
Towers?
Think of. Yes. Yes. This is good. It sounds like. Anyway, so you've got this equipment. It has to stay in place anyway. If a cloud rolls over, if it's nighttime, suddenly you're going to want to draw off the system. So the utility says, well, that's a cost that you're placing on the system, but you're not necessarily paying for it. Why are they concerned about that? Well, if the solar customer doesn't pay for it, then somebody else has to. They don't want to put costs into everybody else's rates. Might raise those rates a little bit and give other customers more of an incentive
to go to solar.
And that's not what they want to have accomplished right now. So they're pushing that issue. They also know that if you were to they got the law changed in the last session, would now enable the PUC, the California PUC, if it wants to put a fixed customer charge on a residential bill anywhere up to $10 a month. That's another factor that would change equation from the perspective of the customer. It might tip the balance away from a system being cost-effective for the users who mostly have power in those lower increments with the lower cost. For the most for the highest usage customers who have to pay the very high charges for those last increments, maybe it still looks cost-effective. But the utility is aware of that. They're all aware of that, and they can see that if they tinker with us a little bit, they might be able to tip the balance just enough that they might be able to slow down solar development.
And when does that charge go into effect?
It doesn't go into effect unless the PUC decides that it should exist and be put in effect. All that happened in the legislation is that the California Commission was given the authority to create a charge and have that charge be as much as $10 if it wanted to.
And there were some good developments in that legislation as well. They increased the net metering cap to 5%.
Yes.
It's
what does that mean?
It's between – so 5% of generation can be net metered. So we're between 1% and 2%. It's essentially the penetration of solar on the grid in any single investor-owned utility. That would be PG&E, Southern California Edison, or SDG&E. So – it gives a lot more space for more people to go solar under net metering.
Okay, because otherwise the cap was previously where?
There was – Steve, do you know where the cap was previously set?
I think it was 2.5%.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
And then it was changed to 5%. Then the question was, how do you interpret 5% of what? And that became a major point of dispute, and I think the – recent legislation solidified a more generous interpretation.
Yes, and a path to eliminate the cap altogether in the future. But the flaw in the utility argument. So when you net meter, you're putting electricity from your solar system back onto the grid. Now it's going to the nearest site of use. So it's going to your neighbor's house. The utility is charging your neighbor a retail rate for that electricity. So they are getting compensated for it at a much lower transmission and distribution cost. So it's basically not going over the grid. It's just going to the neighbor's house. And the California Public Utilities Commission did a study last year that determined that net metered solar customers are paying their fair share. Typically, customers don't offset 100% of their usage. They're paying some remainder to the utility and then some for the solar electricity. The California Public Utilities Commission determined that solar customers are paying their fair share for the maintenance and upkeep of the grid.
So that makes me ask Cal, if as you hear about these changes in Sacramento, what's the mayor and the city's position on this potential change in billing?
The mayor doesn't have a position on the change in the billing. What the mayor has a position on is that we want to get to 100% renewable energy in San Francisco. That's our goal. And we're scratching our heads, trying to figure out exactly how we're going to do that. As I mentioned, the problem of the maximum of 7% solar, the wave. We're going to have to import some hydro. Mm-hmm. What other resources can we use in the city? But we're always heartened to hear when the window opens a little bit more, we can get some more rooftop solar going in the city. We're looking at developing ordinances that will require people to install solar at certain points of time, like during a new construction project. We're looking around at what we can do to help move the market forward.
And what is the city prepared to do should some of these incentives go away, whether it's, you know, this $10 charge gets implemented or some of the subsidies are allowed to sunset? What is the city prepared to do to kind of make sure that solar continues to be adopted in addition to looking out for other sources of renewable energy?
I don't have a direct answer for you in terms of a solution, but we have looked at a range of things in the past to move the market forward. For example, our green building ordinance. We have a LEED Gold standard because at the planning department, we had at one point had a 6 to 8 month wait to get a planning permit, and that costs a lot of money for a developer. We said, hey, if you want to go LEED Gold, a very high level of development of a green building, you go to the front of the line. Well, that cut 6 months off the waiting period. That saved them real money. Before we knew it, every project was moving over into the LEED Gold line. And after another year of that, the Board of Supervisors said, hey, so what's the result? Well, they're finding that the LEED Gold projects were actually coming in at about the same cost. So the board said, well, let's just make it law for all of them, and we'll just make them do it. So we now have a LEED Gold ordinance. So we would be looking at the full
possibility of what the city can do, whether it's a law or a different kind of incentive program, maybe not money, but maybe time or a break on something else that you want in order to encourage the market and keep building it.
Steve?
I just wanted to emphasize that Cal was pointing out the fact that you probably can't get much higher than about a 7% penetration of solar in San Francisco. And I just want to underline the fact that that's probably somewhat atypically low for what could happen in most places. I was just down in Texas and heard from the head of a southern utility. Down there, they figured that they could get to about 35% with solar there. San Francisco is very dense, a lot of multifamily housing, not many flat-top
How much does the fog have to do with it?
Well,
a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little bit. But that's going to definitely lower the output of the system. But I think that in many other places in the country, it can be a significantly higher penetration than that.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight on City Visions as we discuss solar power with our guests Steve Weissman of Berkeley Law, Cal Broomhead of San Francisco's Department of Environment, and Jonathan Bass of Solar City. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. So let's go to a caller, Ruth Ann from El Cerrito. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you very, very much. I wanted to ask the guests, I have a home, and my across-the-street neighbor has solar, and I was all excited about the prospect of, he said, you know, maybe you could get one or two, a small number of panels to put on. And I called a company, in fact, I maybe called a couple. I did not call your company. And when they did the specs, some high-tech figuring out when I gave them my address, they were able to see and all of that. But when I told them what my utility electricity bill had been for the past 6 months, they basically said, you know, you don't use enough. It's not worth it. And I didn't know whether they meant it wasn't worth it for me or it wasn't worth it for them. And I was thinking, yeah, but I really want to do this. And so when I was talking to the executive director of TURN, the Utility Reform Network, he basically told me, you're doing a great job by keeping your bills really, really, really low, because his threshold in some newsletter I got from them was that if your electric bill isn't over $75, it really isn't worth it to you. My electric bill is always under 20.
Wow.
And so he just told me to keep doing that because I really am a low-end user of everything. And I'm thinking, but I would love to go solar. Just
right.
For the feeling that I would just love to do it.
And it feels like the right thing to do.
I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's also the thing that I want to do. And what I'm thinking is, my guess is that companies don't want to do it. You can speak the person who's from the...
Yeah, why don't we get Jonathan from SolarCity to respond to your comment and question there, Ruth Ann?
Thank you, because I was going to say, I thought there was that they didn't want customers coming back to them saying, you know, I thought I was going to save a whole lot of money and I didn't, and it's your fault.
Okay.
Which I would not do.
Okay, let's let Jonathan answer.
So we will typically try to honor the customer's preference. I think all solar companies are very reluctant to offer a product that's not going to save the customer money. Because your situation could change in the long run, you could change your mind about that. There's a certain amount of cost, all-in cost, to installing a solar system, no matter how small it is. And so if you're paying $20 a month, particularly in PG&E territory, for electricity, I agree with the executive director of TURN, you're doing your job for energy efficiency. You're paying a very low rate for that electricity. The rates are tiered. So the less electricity you use, the lower rate you pay. And so, you know, solar is not going to save you money at that level. The executive director's right. Typically, $75, $100 a month is the starting point. But the good news for you is you're paying a very low rate for electricity, and the way that you're using electricity is extremely efficient. So you're doing something very positive for the environment just by using that little.
But it sounds like what Cal said earlier, Ruth Ann, is that maybe you can use some of those solar packs to charge your cell phone or other items. So you can still be part of the solar movement. But it sounds like there really is a line where below that amount, it really doesn't make a lot of sense, even though Ruth Ann really wants to go solar, right?
And Joseph, I can add that she's doing exactly the right thing. It's efficiency first. I'm a $20 a month guy also. I do have a few solar panels on my roof that feed a battery that I sometimes use power tools in the backyard to, just on an off thing, but it's completely disconnected from my house system. I do have solar water heating on my roof. It might be something, Ruth Ann, you take a look at your gas bill, and that might be a place to save. And you can go to Bay Area Energy Upgrade .org on the web and see what their incentives for reducing your that will primarily hit your gas bill and reduce your home energy use that way.
Bay Area
Energy Upgrade
.org. We'll link that to our website, Ruth Ann, and anybody else listening, which is cityvisions at klw.org. So let's go next to Lisa from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello. This is an excellent program, and I am not exactly sure of where I heard this, but I heard that in Berlin has fewer sunny days than San Francisco has, generally speaking, weather-wise, each year, and that something like over 70% of the city's energy comes from solar power. And so I'm wondering what real effect our foggy climate or our lack of sunshine does have on solar viability in San Francisco.
Cal?
I would go back to what Steve was saying. It's really about the economics. You can think of the number of solar hours there are in each day. And in San Francisco, we've got about 4.5 hours of solar that's available on an average day, average throughout the year. Sacramento's about 5. So they're better. LA is about 5. Think about San Francisco. We actually have a lot of clear winter days. They may not be the summer, foggy summer days, but we'd get the clear winter ones. So every location is different. I've been in Germany and saw a lot of cloudy days. But it's really about the economics. Even if you've only got 3.5 or 4 hours per day on an average, if the economics are right, people will still want to do it.
Yeah, Steve.
Yeah, there are really a couple of interesting aspects of what's going on in Germany or what has gone on there. First of all, throughout the European Union, there's been a very solid commitment on a number of states, member states, to push solar and other renewables as hard as possible. So you've got very strong incentives. They have what's referred to as a feed-in tariff system, which means you produce solar, you produce any kind of renewables, we'll pay you a very generous amount for that. They wound up getting into some trouble in terms of making the payments perhaps a little bit too generous, and they've had to fine-tune that program a bit. The other thing is that the installed cost of solar is lower in Germany and probably in Berlin too, I would assume, specifically, than it is in the United States at this point. And there are a lot of questions as to why that's happening. It could have to do with labor costs. It could do with the fact that these incentive programs encourage so much solar production that they've had to make the prices lower in order to sell.
Because the demand is so high.
You're right.
Right. So let's take a break and ask again for some of your green-powered support for KALW. Bob?
The number is 1-800-525-9917. We would like to hear from you now to become a member of this public radio station. A great program, City Visions, comes to you. How long has City Visions been on the air? I'm not sure. A long time. I've been at the station for just about 20 years, and City Visions has been here as long as I've been. 1-800-525-9917 is the number to call, or online at kalw.org. We're looking for 9 calls or clicks during this hour. We know we can do it with your help. 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org. We've got a challenge. A generous listener from Oakland, California, right across the bay where I live, has challenged us to raise $200 during this program. With 9 calls or clicks, we can certainly do that. 1-800-525-9917 or online, once again, at klw.org, our wonderful website, where there's a whole host of information regarding schedules, different ways to listen, whether you're at home, in the car, online. Check it out. Become a member of this public radio station. Join the party. Let's go back to Joseph and City Visions.
Thanks, Bob. And again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing solar power with my guest Steve Weissman from Berkeley Law, Cal Broomhead with San Francisco's Department of Environment, and Jonathan Bass, Vice President of Communications with Solar City. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Are you thinking going solar? You have three experts here who can help chart that path for you. 415-841-4134. Are you already a solar customer? Tell us what your experience has been with this. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. So, Jonathan, I wanted to turn for a moment to Solyndra. So what, if you can, and maybe others might want to chime in here, what happened to Solyndra? That, I mean, when that happened a few years back, everyone thought, oh my God, this is it. This is the turning point. Solar is like tanking. What was it that changed, or was it something specific about Solyndra that made it non-viable? It seems like solar energy companies, installation providers, are really thriving right now. Was Solyndra's timing off, or was there something else?
Well, you're talking about the difference between manufacturing and distribution. So Solyndra was really a victim of the industry's success at reducing its cost. Solyndra had a very specific application. It was a non-penetrating technology for commercial rooftops, primarily a new cylindrical solar panel. It had a valid application, but it was very expensive to manufacture. And during the time they were developing it, the cost of polysilicon-based modules, which are the most common modules, fell dramatically. So when Solyndra came to market with its technology, it couldn't compete with the technology that was out there. Now, that was great news for companies like ours and other companies that were providing solar electricity to customers, because the cost of technology was reducing the cost that we could provide to customers. It was allowing customers to save more money. It was bad news for Solyndra and some other manufacturers who couldn't compete on price.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, tell us about the health of the marketplace right now.
Solar is not a fully mature industry yet, and the manufacturing side for sure. And in an industry that's still growing up, you're going to have a lot of experiments with different business approaches and different technological models. You're going to have some companies that are going to make it, some that are not. Solyndra is really not the only manufacturer that went belly up. It was just much more well-known because it happened to have a loan guarantee from the federal government and a political party, frankly, that wanted to make a lot of fuss about that. But you've got also the potential for lots of mergers. I think that it's going to be a number of years for this particular technology to pan out. To some extent, Solyndra is not a good example, but to some extent, one set of solar cells is like another. And so it's a fairly interchangeable commodity, and you are going to have winners and losers. But that's what you want to have happen. You want to have that level of competition that's going to allow the most efficient and best products, hopefully, to rise to the top.
So is it that in the solar sphere that perhaps that innovation is not quite as important as it is in other industries? Is it that, you know, what we've got works so well that there won't be a lot of innovation moving forward? And is that a bad thing?
Well, there's a strong yearning for innovation. There's always going to be a need to try to bring the costs down a little bit more. A lot of that is going to be innovation in manufacturing techniques, having more efficient assembly lines, et cetera. But also, as I think Jonathan and maybe even Cal alluded to earlier, there's this issue as to how much efficiency you're getting out of these solar cells. You know, about maybe, if you're lucky, upwards of maybe 15% of the energy that's hitting the solar cells gets translated into usable electricity. If you could double that, you can imagine what that does to the cost effectiveness of the systems. So I think you're going to continue to see efforts to innovate. Cal also, I think, alluded to the fact that you can make these systems much more self-contained. A lot of systems, you have the solar arrays in one place, and you have something that's called an inverter that turns the solar energy into alternating current. And in some systems, that's a separate box. But then there are other kinds of modular installations now where you can have little mini inverters included in each solar panel, and that might make things a little bit more flexible and reduce some of the installation costs. So you're going to continue to see refinements. I certainly wouldn't say everything's wonderful right now and there's no need for any further development.
Yeah. So, and do you see funding or support that's going to help push that innovation, given how the cost has come down?
Well, I think that what's going to drive that is going to be volume, and we've seen a steady increase in the number of installed solar panels. And if that continues to occur, you show that pattern to investors, and then I think you're still going to have confidence in trying to promote new technologies. However, again, as I said, it's been the federal and state government policies and incentives that have really dictated the current level of attractiveness of the prices of solar. And if you start losing those, then it may be very difficult to get that level of investment.
Cal?
No,
you're fine?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, fine.
Great.
He said it better than
anyone else.
I did want to make one point.
Yes, Jonathan.
I think the incentives and the government support have been very, very important. But if you look at a place like California, the California Solar Initiative, a few years ago, it was $2-3 a watt. So that comes out to $10, $15, sometimes $20,000 a system for a larger system. In PG&E, that's gone. You know, it's zero. And we can offer the same deal to the customer today that we did a couple years ago. I think it shows how successful the industries have been at reducing its dependence on incentives. So the entire industry is reducing costs. Even the reduction of the ITC in 2016, the 30% tax credit that Steve alluded to earlier, the industry has a path to reduce costs to offset the reduction in that incentive. So I think while incentives have been very important, and they've been very important to all energy industries in the United States, including fossil fuel and nuclear especially, I think that the solar industry, more than any other, has reduced its dependence faster. And we've got a path to parity without incentives in the next 5 years.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Let's go to Jim in San Francisco. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an architect, and we've designed buildings and installed quite a few solar systems, some mostly residential and some commercial. And it always seems to me that the commercial ones end up being a lot more expensive than residential. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the different credits and things like that and whether they vary from residential or commercial. And what I guess one of the people just said sounds like a lot of the incentives are going away and you're just ending up paying for systems.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Jonathan.
Yes. So commercials, I'm surprised to hear you to say that commercial systems are more. I wouldn't expect them to be more on a per watt basis or a per kilowatt basis. You know, obviously, a larger system is going to cost more to install, but on a per watt or per kilowatt basis, a commercial system should cost less. Now, you know, a commercial system on a small business sometimes can be a little bit more expensive. It can more resemble a residential system in construction costs. But I'm surprised to hear that commercial system is more on a kilowatt or per watt basis. Typically, the residential incentives are higher. They start higher and they fall more gradually than the commercial incentives. That's going to vary by utility territory and location. But that might be an incentive issue in your particular location. That may be the issue.
So let's we have about 5 minutes left in the program. Let's focus on the nuts and bolts that consumers need to consider or questions they need to be asking as they consider going solar. So, Steve, would you like to start that off? What kinds of things does the average homeowner have to think about when they're going solar?
Well, I think we hit upon one earlier, which was the question of whether your bill is high enough to give you the sufficient economic incentive to move forward with solar. Having cleared that hurdle,
that's around $75 we said a month.
That's what I think Jonathan was saying.
That would probably be a good starting point. It's going to depend on the situation. If you've got a good south-facing roof and a very simple installation that's low cost, it could be lower than that. But $75 to $100 a month is a good, in PG&E territory, that's a good starting point.
Okay. I think you just touched on issue number two. Do you have a roof that's large enough to support a system of modest size, and can you situate that solar system in a way that's going to take advantage of the strongest part of the day's sun, which means you want to be south to southwest, I think. And so that's going to be another issue.
I think you generally want to be in the bottom half of that 180 degrees. So you can face east or west and get a lot of production as well. You just don't want to be anything north of that 180 degrees. North, northeast, northwest are not going to work. But east and west can work quite well in certain situations.
So having gone that far, then the next question really is, do you want to own a system? Do you want to lease one? Do you want to just buy the output from a system that's on your roof? Some of solar companies now are going out of their way to advertise to suggest that the least expensive way to get a system might be to buy it. If that would be a bit of a change, I think, from what was going on historically, where really I think probably one of the most economical things you could do would be usually to agree to buy the output of the system and then pay for it up front so that you're letting the company take advantage of getting the money now, so they're willing to sell it to you for less. So you have these kind of questions about what you want your relationship to the solar to be. Also, if you lease it or take a power purchase agreement, then the company's on the hook for the system continuing to produce, usually for a 20-year period. So they're going to be responsible for tracking your output, for fixing something if it breaks, for writing you a check in the case of a power purchase agreement if you aren't getting the output from the system that you're supposed to. So there are potential advantages and disadvantages to going either way. So those are going to be issues you're going to want to look at as well.
Okay. Callie, do you want to add to that?
I was just going to say it kind of depends on the cost of money. You know, if you're able to get a 3% equity HELOC loan from your credit union or your bank, then this may not be – it may be a better way to go is just pay for it outright and take your loan payments. You'll have to calculate that out and see what's going to work for you. And then the issue of a maintenance program, you can sign up, pay for an additional maintenance program up top. So there are a lot of variations here, things you can do.
Then I think the other big question is who do you want to enter into your business relationship with? There are a few very large companies. There are a lot of very small ones. I've been able to see just in my own neighborhood watching different people choose different companies. Sometimes the systems get installed a lot faster. Sometimes the installation process is sharper. So you want to decide who you want to do business with, too.
And is there any reason to wait at this point? We did talk about innovations coming down the road. We don't know how long, but we did think that the innovations will only come if more people adopt solar. So any advice there if people are saying, you know what, maybe now's not the time?
I think you should cash in on the savings. If you're going to get a system, get it when you have the chance to take as full advantage of it as possible. If you get into a 20-year deal or have a system you buy that could last for 25, 30 years, start taking advantage of it now.
And Cal, you'll have the last word. Where's a place where residents in San Francisco, at least, could learn about the incentive programs and how to really negotiate this territory?
Go to gosolarsf.org.
Great.
That's our Public Utilities Commission's website. Has all the information about the incentive levels, et cetera. There's also you can access a list of local contractors. It'll tell you, give you the information that you need to be able to move forward.
Great. And that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Steve Weissman of Berkeley Law, Cal Broomhead of the San Francisco Department of Environment, and Jonathan Bass with Solar City. Thanks to all of you for being on the program this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to other shows and to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KLW. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. Join my co-host, David Onick, next Monday for a conversation with Deborah Cullinan, the recently new executive director of the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
Thank you.